I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Kia ora, g'day and welcome to the History of Aotearoa New Zealand, episode 129, Chasing Geese. This podcast is recorded in Te Whanganui Atara, on the rohe of Mua'upoko, Taranaki Whānui, Te Atiyawa and Ngāti Toa Rangatira. We are generously supported by our amazing patrons, such as Jack, Desiree and Roger. If you want to support Hans, go to patreon.com/historyaotearoa. Last time, we began our journey into the age of European exploration by talking about Terra Australis, the rise of the Dutch Empire, and the formation of the Dutch East India Company, also known as the VOC. All of this was to serve as background context, to help you understand the world that our main character was born into, and introduce some of the main concepts and entities that will play a large role in his life. Today, we will discuss what we know of Abel Tasman's early life, and how he came to join the VOC. Tasman was born in 1603 in Lutjehast near Groningen in the northern Netherlands. Unfortunately, we don't know a huge amount about his early life, such as whether he had siblings or what his parents did for work. But what we do know is that he likely was from a working class background. We guess this because after he got married, his home address was in Ter Ketelsteeg, which I wasn't able to find a pronunciation for, so apologies if I got that wrong. This was, and possibly still is, an alleyway in Amsterdam, which translates to Tar Kettle Lane, which doesn't sound like an amazing place to live. This alleyway likely had a lot of houses cramped in together, and the name, Tar Kettle Lane, probably relates to the kind of work that was going on there. So something related to tar, meaning it was probably very stinky. So chances are, if Tasman's family had a bit of money behind them, then when he became an adult, he likely would have lived somewhere a bit nicer. Or at least on a street that had a more attractive name. Despite coming from a poor family, Tasman seems to have gotten a somewhat decent education, because we also know that by his adulthood, he was literate. The Dutch Republic did have a higher literacy rate than other countries at the time, but it was still pretty rare for working class people in the early 17th century to be able to read and write. As such, it was a tangible way for those in the lower classes to help their children have a chance at a better future, especially since the ability to read and write was a core skill if you wanted to rise through the ranks in the rapidly expanding bureaucracy of the VOC. Sometime in his early 20s, Tasman signed up to work as a sailor on the ships of the Dutch Republic, probably doing mostly manual labour. Around this time, he got married and had a daughter. But it seems that this marriage didn't last for some reason, because a few years later, in 1631, the 28-year-old Abel Tasman gets remarried to the 21-year-old Janneke Tjaris. What's interesting is that Tasman signs the marriage certificate with his name, whereas Janneke signs with just a couple of crosses. So, it's possible that she wasn't literate, and was also from a working class background, which lends a little more evidence to the fact that Tasman probably had a similar background, because he would have probably married within the same class. This marriage is the first time that Tasman appears in the historical record, and he disappears just as abruptly until a few years later, in 1634, where he is seen as the first mate of a VOC ship leaving Batavia, the capital of the Dutch East Indies. Later that same year, he would be given command of his own ship, the Mocha. So, sometime between 1631 and 1634, Tasman joined the VOC proper and rose through the ranks to become a captain in his own right. One source even claims that he signed his contract in 1633, meaning he must have made a good impression to be promoted so quickly. Initially, Janneke didn't come with Tasman, instead remaining at their home in Amsterdam. And it's here, when Tasman is in his early 30s, that his life is much more well documented. Tasman was given a fairly standard assignment in his new ship. He was to sail as part of a fleet to the nearby Maluku Islands, sometimes called the Spice Islands, to chart various sailing routes and reassess the coastline of one of the islands to update the VOC's maps. Again, this sort of assignment was pretty common for the kind of profession that Tasman was in, and it was within mostly well-known waters, so there wasn't really any reason to think that there would be too many issues. Since I'm drawing your attention to that, you can probably guess that there was lots of issues. Pretty much from the get-go, the voyage was plagued with problems. The ship wasn't very well maintained, in part because there was a lack of materials to fix any damage, there was a lack of food for the crew, and disease was rampant, which, to be fair, wasn't terribly abnormal for Europeans in the tropical climate. To add to the problems, occasionally, when Tasman's crew needed to go ashore, they would be attacked by some of the indigenous peoples who lived on the islands, resulting in some of his men being injured or killed. While the whole thing was a bit of a shit show, in terms of its goals, the voyage was actually very successful. It provided the VOC with more sailing routes with predictable conditions that they could give to other ships travelling through the area. For Tasman, who possibly barely made it out alive, this was a huge learning experience. This was the first time he had been given command of a ship, and so a lot of his naval and leadership skills were developed on this voyage. Skills that he would need for the challenges ahead, including learning the lesson that when you're dealing with unknown communities and cultures, caution should be exercised. Though it should be noted, leniency, or dare I say it, compassion for those communities, was not the lesson he took from this. After his initial job was done, Tasman was tasked with firming up Dutch dominance in Maluku. Remember that the whole of Indonesia was essentially being fought over, with the Spanish and Portuguese on one side and the Dutch on the other, as part of the larger 80 Years' War, which in turn was now itself a small part of the much larger 30 Years' War, one of Europe's bloodiest conflicts. In fact, Ambon Island, part of the Maluku Islands, was captured from the Portuguese by the Dutch only in 1605, about three decades prior. However, this war between the Iberian powers and the Low Countries wasn't always hot, and during the periods where there wasn't active hostilities, they would still try to take as much land and trade from each other as possible. Which is basically what Tasman did over the next 2 years. He would sail around the Maluku Islands, negotiating with local indigenous leaders for trade of their spices. Though, if Tasman's charisma wasn't convincing enough, then there was still the option to show that he meant business, by blockading the port to starve them of trade. Generally though, this wasn't terribly interesting work, except for the odd skirmish with rebels, smugglers, or one of the European powers in the region. Towards the end of this 2 year period, Tasman got himself into a bit of hot water with his crew. By and large, he seems to have maintained respect and discipline on his ships, but, as was common at the time, punishments could be rather harsh, and, as we will see in future episodes, there were a few occasions that Tasman just pushed things a little bit too far. In this case, he was accused of cutting the crew's rations and using that to, quote, line his own purse, end quote. Ultimately, this accusation didn't go anywhere, and one source suggests that the crew was just more willing to push back on Tasman because they knew he had been promoted through the ranks, rather than getting his command due to any noble birth. Essentially, they may have seen him as one of them instead of a superior officer. It's not clear what is true in this situation. It's certainly plausible that Tasman may have been trying to pull a fast one by reducing the rations of the crew with the intent to sell what was left. But it's also possible that the crew just took this as an opportunity to test their new captain and see if he could be pushed around. In 1636, Tasman seems to have finished the terms of his contract that he initially signed with the VOC, because he sailed from the Maluku Islands to Batavia, and then promptly boarded a ship filled with spices bound for the Netherlands. He wasn't just a passenger, though. He was the third most highly ranked officer, helping to navigate the ships along the route past the Cape of Good Hope in southern Africa, and then north to Europe, possibly as a way to pay for passage. Once back in the Netherlands, he spent the next 12 or so months hanging out with his family, doing whatever families do in the 17th century. Somewhere around here, Tasman goes back to the VOC and negotiates a new contract, this time for a 10-year term. And as part of that, the company agreed to let him bring his wife and daughter to his first marriage. Presumably, this involved some sort of agreement about a house for his family in Batavia and who would pay for it, since they would need to live somewhere while he was out sailing around. But I wasn't able to find any information on that. Though it does seem that they retained ownership of their house in Amsterdam. However, again, it isn't clear why or whether the house was rented out after they departed. It's possible that they intended to return to Europe at some point, which would explain keeping the house, but, mild spoilers, that isn't really what ends up happening. By 1638, Tasman had returned to the East Indies, with his family joining him. He spent the next year doing some smaller missions, like supply runs to colonies. And then, in 1639, Tasman was given a very interesting assignment. He was to be part of a dangerous expedition into the Pacific. Their goal? To find the islands of Rica de Oro and Rica de Plata, Spanish for rich in gold and rich in silver, respectively. It's not too hard to figure out why the VOC was interested in these islands. As you might know, European naming conventions around this time were often rather literal. This expedition was going to be led by a man named Quast, who was in fact the leader of the voyage when Tasman sailed back to Europe. So the two were already quite well acquainted. Before we talk about the expedition itself, though, I want to introduce a man who was likely instrumental in getting it commissioned. In fact, this won't be the last time he convinces the company to undertake a voyage like this into the Pacific. He was extremely important in the planning and execution of the expedition that would bring Aotearoa onto European maps. So, he deserves a little bit of an introduction. Franz Visscher joined the VOC roughly around the same time Tasman did, and like his colleague, he had spent a fair amount of time at sea before he joined the company properly. When he signed his contract and headed to the East Indies, Visscher had been working as a navigator for them on a freelance basis. So he was familiar with how they operated, and obviously liked them enough to properly join their ranks. After arriving in the East Indies, Visscher was tasked with charting the southern coasts of Japan and the mainland of Southeast Asia. He must have proved himself highly skilled and invaluable, because he quickly became an extremely busy man, as the company tried to make the best use of his skills, resulting in him being the go-to guy for any questions of cartography. In fact, by 1637, he was effectively the VOC's chief geographer and cartographer in the East Indies. Visscher was very keen on further exploring the Pacific, and given his skills and the respect they had garnered him within the company, his bosses tended to take his recommendations quite seriously. He didn't have to fight them too hard, though, as the newly appointed Governor-General of the Dutch East Indies was also quite keen on funding exploratory voyages, to the point where he wanted to make it the VOC's highest priority. You might have heard of him, too, at least if you're Australian. Anthony Van Diemen. Given their mutual interests, Visscher and Van Diemen worked quite closely to commission expeditions in search for new lands. Visscher would provide the proposal, what we today might call a business case if you're in the corporate world, and this would detail what they wanted to achieve, the sailing routes to be taken, the ships and supplies needed, and that sort of thing. Van Diemen would then take this to the Council of Batavia, the ruling body of the Dutch East Indies that he was the leader of, and try to convince them that the expedition was a good idea. Once the council agreed, the next step was usually to send a letter back to the Netherlands addressed to the Heerden 17, the leaders of the entire VOC, asking for their approval. As you might expect, this process could take quite some time, especially given it would take a few months to send a letter to Europe, and then the same time again to get a reply. As such, the initial idea for the Quast expedition was brought up to Van Diemen in 1635, but the ships wouldn't actually leave until 4 years later. Interestingly, the person who originally brought this to Van Diemen was a mid-tier merchant working in Japan, who found out that the Spanish had visited these islands some years before and had been unable to find them since. His thought was that if the VOC managed to find the islands again and establish a mining colony or a trade relationship with any locals, then that would be a huge financial win for the company. Not to mention a moral victory over the Spanish at refinding, quote-unquote, their islands before them. Visscher, possibly with some help from Tasman, put together an official proposal to find the islands brimming with gold and silver, which was approved in 1637. This venture greatly interested the Heerden 17, who had been looking to expand the company's portfolio. At the moment, the VOC was focused on the spice trade out of the East Indies, but they were very interested in setting up gold and silver mines in various locations around the Pacific. The idea behind this, or perhaps the hope, was that they might hit it big, like the Spanish did in America. But the advantage that Columbus and Cortez had was that they were ahead of the game. Jeremy Irons from the movie Margin Call puts this quite nicely.
There are three ways to make a living in this business. Be first, be smarter, or cheat. No, I don't cheat. And although I like to think we have some pretty smart people in this building, it sure is a hell of a lot easier to just be first.
Now, neither the Spanish or Dutch empires were above cheating, but the rest of the sentiment was the same. The VOC and the Netherlands as a whole had spent decades cultivating the best and brightest people to drive their engine of commerce. And although they certainly felt like they could outwit the Spanish if it came to that, it would just be a shitload easier if they were the ones to get there first. Typically, for expeditions like this, the Governor General would give a set of instructions to the commander, detailing what he expected them to achieve, how he wanted them to conduct themselves, how long he expected them to be gone for, and what route he wanted them to sail, among a whole bunch of other things. In this case, though, Van Diemen was unusually vague on what he wanted them to do and where he wanted them to go, leaving most of that up to Quast. This was possibly to ensure that the location of the islands remained a secret, especially if they managed to actually find them. They couldn't risk Spain learning about the expedition and ultimately where the islands were. If they did, it would start a race to get there first, likely followed by violence as the loser of the race sought to eject the winner, with any indigenous peoples getting caught in the crossfire. Not that they cared about that, though. So the fewer people that knew what they were doing and the actual route they would take, the better. It would take them the next couple of years to get everything prepared, because these were expensive endeavours with lots of moving parts. Plus, there was a war on, which complicated matters. As part of the preparations, the officers were assigned their positions, with Tasman becoming the skipper of one of the two ships they would take, the other being captained by Quast himself. And in fact, Tasman was the second in command of the expedition as a whole. It's also worth mentioning that, even with some of the details being quite vague, Van Diemen did tell the pair that if they find the islands with time to spare, they should explore the coasts of Korea, China, and eastern Siberia. Then, when they were done with that, they should head over to the west coast of North America and nick some silver from the Spanish. However, their primary goal was to find Rica de Oro and Rica de Plata. With everything prepared, the ships set off from Batavia in 1639. Tasman and Quast hoping that this would be their big break. So, what was the route they took and how did it go? They knew that the islands were somewhere to the south of Japan, and they had a stretch of ocean that they wanted to investigate around Iwo Jima. I won't go too into the details of the expedition, because there actually wasn't a whole lot that happened. They sailed around the eastern Philippine Sea, looking for the Glittering Isles, but the crew were constantly sick or weak from the supplied food being so awful. On top of this, the ships themselves were not looking too hot. The rigging was severely damaged, and the hull full of leaks, which is never a good sign when you're in the middle of the ocean. They did stop off at a couple of islands, but found that they weren't bursting at the seams with shiny metal as expected. When the ships docked at Taiwan, having not found what they were looking for after 5 months at sea, half the crew on Tasman's ship was dead, and what crew was left would have to man ships that were barely floating to begin with. It probably isn't hugely surprising then that Quast decided that it would be unwise to continue their search, and as such sailed back to Batavia. It's not too much of an exaggeration to say that the Quast expedition was a total failure. They lost dozens of men due to provisioning issues, the ships were not fit for purpose and had to be largely repaired while on the go, which was difficult given they had been provided with very little material with which to make repairs, and of course, ultimately, they didn't even find what they were looking for, meaning there was every chance that the Spanish might get to the islands first. A lot of money had just been flushed down the toilet for no gain, and you would think that failure of this magnitude would mean heads would roll, perhaps literally. However, that wasn't the case. Van Diemen and Tasman just took this to be a test run that they could build from for future voyages. As you might say in modern corporate lingo, they had a bunch of learnings. Those being, ensure you have enough food, water, and materials, keep the crew fed and treat them well, make navigation an extremely high priority when at sea, ensure that the ships selected were up to the task of long-distance sailing in unknown waters, and generally, to just plan better. Now, I'm not a fancy 17th century businessman looking to find tiny islands in the largest ocean on the planet, but I would have thought most of that should have been pretty fucking obvious. Having acknowledged these pain points, Van Diemen took it offline to do some top-down whiteboarding, hoping to break down silos between his teams and trim the fat off the plan, before touching base with his bosses to give them his thoughts on what they should do to get this thing to market. What I mean is, even though the Quast expedition failed, the Governor General was keen to give it another go. But even if Van Diemen and Tasman weren't admitting to themselves what a massive cock-up this was, surely, the Heeren 17 would look at the numbers, assess the probabilities of success, and toss the whole thing out.
No, of course they didn't!
What they actually did was commission another expedition in 1643 to do the exact same thing. And I can tell you, without having done any research on that voyage, they did not find those islands. How can I be so confident with absolutely jack shit to back it up? Here's the twist, Rica de Oro and Rica de Plata don't exist. Now, I know what you're saying. Hindsight is 2020. We know that those islands don't exist because we've unlocked satellites in the tech tree. And so I understand if you're thinking I'm being unduly harsh to the VOC for not knowing a landmass didn't exist given their very limited information. However, the part of the story that I missed out was where the idea of this pair of islands came from. Remember, it came to Van Diemen's attention by a merchant working for the company in Japan. But that merchant had to get the information from somewhere else. I think it's interesting to highlight the kind of information that the VOC was basing their decisions on. Again, these expeditions were costly in time, money, and manpower. As someone with the benefit of that hindsight, you would think the company wouldn't commission two ships, each with a full complement of salaried crew, put them under two of their most experienced officers, and then allow them to be indisposed on this purely exploratory voyage for months, meaning neither the ships nor the crew could be utilized if hostilities with Spain flared up, unless they had good, concrete evidence that these islands could be found. Right? Well, that depends on your definition of good, reliable intel, because back in the 17th century, I'm fairly certain that their definition was a bit looser. So, where did this information come from that the VOC were comfortable funding two costly expeditions? Well, it's a bit of a lengthy tale, but to boil it down, this all stemmed from a story recounted by a Spanish priest in Mexico in 1583. The priest heard it from a guy who was apparently related to the captain of a Portuguese ship in the 1520s and 30s, so about 100 years before the Quast expedition. This Portuguese vessel was apparently blown off course east of Japan and found two islands. Upon landing on the islands, they found some people there and did some trades, obtaining silver, silk, and other goods. While their merchants were doing the trading, the Portuguese officers figured out that they were somewhere far to the east of Japan based on the stars and other navigation calculations. They also found that the locals spoke a language similar to, but certainly distinct, from Japan and China. If they were on the Japanese mainland, then they would have expected the locals to speak the same Japanese language they were familiar with. So, since the people didn't, the Portuguese guessed they must be somewhere else. As a side note, the Portuguese called these new lands the Islands of the Armenian, so named because the merchant who did the profitable trading for the Portuguese ship was Armenian. Having made a tidy profit, the Portuguese left the islands, having noted down where they thought they were, and subsequently no one used that information or followed up on it for quite some time. It wouldn't be until about 60 years later, in 1586, when a Spanish ship was making a fairly usual trip across the Pacific. As it so happened, they were roughly in the area where these islands were meant to be, and apparently had some time to spare, so they decided to follow up on the story and see what they could find. Obviously, what they found was not a hell of a lot. The Spanish tried again in 1611, this time by order of the Viceroy of Mexico. He sent a ship to Japan for an unrelated reason, and again wanted the captain to search for the two islands along the way. Naturally, he was unsuccessful. A couple decades later, a Dutch VOC officer in Japan heard this story about lost islands of gold and silver and took it to the Governor General and the Batavian Council. They thought the story was not only a ripper, but that it was credible enough to send their own people to try and succeed where the Spanish had twice failed. Which is how the 1639 expedition under Quast got going. Of course, the problem for us today is that we now know no islands east of Japan fit this description of being filled with precious metals, silk, and other riches. So, it begs the question, when that Portuguese ship was blown off course, where did it land? The most likely explanation is that they actually ended up on the Japanese mainland, the exact place where they thought they weren't, and the two pieces of evidence the Portuguese had can be pretty easily explained. For the navigational calculations, it's probably just a simple matter of being wrong. During the 16th century, calculating your position on the planet with a high degree of accuracy was a science still very much in its infancy. As I've said last episode, and as we'll see in future episodes, calculating coordinates was very difficult, and officers frequently disagreed on whether those calculations had been done properly. This had resulted in islands that did actually exist being improperly recorded on maps. And so when other captains arrived at the same place a few years later, they thought it was a different island than the one labelled, because their calculations said they were hundreds of kilometres away. So their calculations being wrong is not necessarily that surprising. This leaves the language that the locals were speaking, which the Portuguese recognised was related to Japanese, but wasn't actually Japanese. Well, as it turns out, they were probably wrong on that one too. The Portuguese experience of the Japanese language was mostly limited to the region of Nagasaki in the south. And so it's thought that the Portuguese didn't recognize the local dialect as being the same language as the people in Nagasaki. This would make a lot of sense if the ship had landed much further north. In that situation, the people were likely speaking a local Japanese dialect, and because the Portuguese weren't familiar with any other dialects outside of the south, the language they were hearing would sound like it was distinct, but somewhat related to what they knew as Japanese. In the same way that a non-English speaker who's only familiar with American English might be confused when I say, "Let me get out of my togs, I'll put my jandals on, and I'll pop down to the dairy and grab us all ice blocks." So, that is what the Quast expedition was based on. Back then, this sort of story was seen as being very credible. The Portuguese had presented evidence to suggest these were new islands unknown to Europe. And the fact the Spanish were willing to also spend time and resources searching for them only lent credibility to the story, since they were a big, powerful empire, and they wouldn't go chasing fantasies like lost islands of gold and silver. I think this shows not only the greed and insatiable hunger of these empires, although it certainly does show that, but also that allure of mystery, that kind of promise and excitement of infinite possibilities. When someone sails beyond the edge of the map, they're in a place that no one has been before, and whatever they discovered could get them a place in the big book of history. People in the 17th century, looking at a map with monsters dancing around an empty sea, would have had possibly similar thoughts to us when we look up at the stars today. What's out there? Who is out there? And how could it make me rich? Next time, we will talk about what happened after the Quast expedition and how it generated a seed that grew into what we know Tasman for today. If you want to get in touch, my email and social media are on historyaotearoa.com. Aotearoa spelt Aotearoa. You can also find helpful resources there like transcripts and sources. If you would like to support Hans, you can do so through donating via Patreon or just giving us a review. As always, haere tū atu, hoki tū mai. See you next time.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.